Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and joining me on the phone, I welcome Imani Capri, who is one of the authors, and Misha Tyler, another author. Allow me to thank you all in advance for sharing your thoughts and your experiences surrounding this difficult discussion topic. Rape is a crime of forcing someone into sexual activity, in particular sexual penetration against his or her will, through use of physical force, threat of injury, or other duress. It is also rape if the victim is unable to say no due to the effects of drugs or alcohol or is under the legal age of consent. The concept of rape dates to Greek mythology, when to rape a person meant to capture the person for the purpose of enslavement. In the United States, there is no national rape law. Instead, each state drafts its own laws to deal with sexual aggression. There is no gender-neutral legal classification about what constitutes rape in the United States. The rape of females is best known and most reported form of rape in the U.S. Between 1 in 3 and 1 in 6 women will be sexually assaulted within their lifetime, according to Rape Abuse and Incest National Network. 1.7 women have been victims of rape and attempted rape in the U.S. More than 32,000 pregnancies result from male-female rape every year. Imani and Misha, share with us what was the impetus for writing Things We Haven't Said.
Well, thank you for the invitation to participate in this interview today. My understanding, Aaron Mouton is a youth or teen librarian, and so she had been planning an event with some of the teens who participate in a summer program, and they were broken into groups brainstorming ideas for, I guess, this movie that they were going to write and produce. And she broke the teens into groups. And so she was walking around listening to some of their brainstorming ideas, and she heard someone mention the word rape. And her initial response to hearing that as one of the brainstorming topics, and then kind of the response that she had in the moment and observing how some of the other teens responded to that word, and I think the young lady who actually brought up the word, is kind of what stirred her to want to create the anthology, which is Things We Haven't Said, and to create a more current and user-friendly reference for teenagers, specifically on the topic of sexual violence and assault.
Okay. Misha.
And that was my understanding of how the anthology came into creation also.
The written word can be very, very powerful and therapeutic. How was it for you all as authors in this anthology? What purpose did it serve?
Well, for me, it really gave me the opportunity to separate myself from my assault, just in documenting it and writing about it. I mean, it's something I've been working on for a while, just kind of trying to put a lot of those experiences into words so I could separate a little bit, but then also have the ability to share it in a way where it didn't feel as personal, but it was still personal.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so for me, being able to participate by contributing my story to Things We Haven't Said was was really about just being able to continue to use my voice and my story to help encourage other people. I've been speaking and using my story as an advocate for empowerment around the issue of sexual violence for a number of years now. The end of last year, I also had the great opportunity to participate in a panel interview that was aired on CBS National Evening News and Morning News. And I also did some other local media, another local media interview with a CBS affiliate. And then over the years, I've just used my voice to speak out. I've been in an article in the Christian Science Monitor and some other projects. So to me, the invitation to participate in Things We Haven't Said was just an extension of my personal mission to help bring empowerment and enlightenment around the issue of sexual violence.
Do you make a distinction, or will you make a distinction, and this is, again, to both of you, between the victim and the survivor? Are they the same? How do they differ? I mean, because you hear so much about those two terms, and there seems to be, you know, some real question about who is the victim versus the survivor, and can one be a victim and be a survivor? So would you make that distinction for me and my listening audience?
I think there's a distinction. I feel more that I adhere to the idea of a survivor, less than a victim. I feel there's some power lost in that idea of being a victim, as if, you know, there's no self-advocacy in the way of being victimized. As a survivor, I feel like that's a work in progress.
Okay.
It's something that's active. It's something that
I
feel like, for me, that I'm something that I'm working on and engaged in, less something that happened to me.
Mm-hmm. It's something that's kind of ongoing.
Yes.
Okay. Anything you would like to add on that, Imani?
I think there is a distinction. To agree with Misha, victim really has in our society a connotation of being powerless and not having control over a situation. Whereas, as Misha said, the term survivor does imply that you have overcome something, that you made it through something. However, unfortunately, my personal opinion is that the term survivor still carries with it a negative connotation. So in my own journey, I've kind of had an evolution. Like, at one time, I saw myself as a victim.
Mm-hmm.
Another time, I saw myself as a survivor. More recently, I identify as an advocate. You know, and today, I really just prefer to be identified as a human being who had this particular experience.
Mm-hmm.
Who decided to take her power back and focus on her healing, and then to share that message and to really look at, okay, what are universal themes of my experience that can help anyone who's gone through anything challenging, and understanding that no matter what it is that we experience, we each get to make a choice about how we're going to use that experience. We could use that experience and be stuck, or we could use that experience to help propel us into becoming healed, becoming stronger, digging to find more of the value in our life. So I think with the term of victim being out there in society, you know, with the Me Too movement and the Time's Up movement, I really feel like there is this push to reconsider a lot of things, including the terminology and the language that we use around the issue.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Because the term victim just doesn't give people who have experienced sexual trauma the opportunity to be recognized for the power of having survived, the power of moving forward, even if it's a difficult process. So victim is not really a term that I personally like to use. And, you know, I don't knock anybody who uses victim or anybody who uses survivor, but just in my own personal journey, advocate or just a human being who decided to really do her healing work and then start to figure out how to take my life back and reclaim power inside my life is what I prefer.
Well, I thank you both for sharing those perspectives, because it seems like there's been a lot of debate about, in my reading and preparation for the program, there was a lot of debate with victim and survivor. And if you are going to use those terms, it seems like an individual can be both.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to me, you know, it just seems like one could be both. Another common theme that I picked up throughout the anthology was often that the perpetrator is known many, many times. The perpetrator seems to be someone that the advocate is very much aware of. They're not somebody foreign. And would you all comment on that particular aspect?
Yeah, I would say in my case, my perpetrator was my stepfather.
Mm-hmm.
And he was someone who really preyed upon the absence of my biological father. I mean, even though I always knew who my biological father was and had a relationship with him until his mother died, my paternal grandmother died, and then he just kind of spiraled into alcoholism and other struggles that caused there to be a big gap in absence of his presence. And so, you know, my mom started dating this man, and he was charming. He was a graduate of an Ivy League school.
Mm-hmm.
He was an officer, a reserve officer in the Army. You know, he had a black belt in martial arts. I mean, nothing about him screamed sexual perpetrator until after he had gained, you know, my trust, my mom's
confidence.
Trust.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so I really think that whole myth of stranger danger, I wouldn't say that it's non-existent because it does exist, but the facts are that many more perpetrators of sexual assault and sexual abuse against children, teenagers, and even against adults is more often with people who are known.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a conversational forum for teens and other interested folks. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. Did you know that the majority of sexual abuse perpetrators are known to their victims, whether the victims are children or adults? And remember, not all perpetrators are adults. We went on break, and Misha, and I didn't know if you had some comments that you wanted to make.
My perpetrator, I knew also, and really took advantage of me in a situation where I was homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And it really pushed me to a place where I kind of regressed back to my initial sexual abuse. So for a while, I was just, I guess I had enough denial that I pushed my sexual abuse to a place where it was something I didn't remember till I was a little older, but it definitely influenced a lot of my behavior ways. I'm just now starting to see. So at that time, I wasn't even aware, really, mm-hmm. that I was being sexually abused until much later. And as I start to unpack that, it became very apparent.
Mm-hmm.
So it was definitely somebody I knew.
Well, I know often children don't know that they have been violated, and they're unable to even convey the circumstances just because of the milieu and the environment and how it all happened. So, you know, that makes a lot of sense, Misha, that that's what happened. How did you, both of you, handle this abuse? How did you handle what you were experiencing?
Go ahead,
Misha.
Oh. At the time for me, I think I kind of got self-destructive and drank a lot. The only way I could figure, and it wasn't even a conscious choice, I just didn't, I knew something was off, but I didn't know how else to handle it. So I think I numbed my way through most of that period of time because I just wasn't fully cognizant of a lot of my behaviors and what I was experiencing, or even that it wasn't something that was supposed to be happening.
I think for me, I just, you know, when anything inappropriate first happened, which it started with an inappropriate touch for me, I told my mother. She confronted him. He didn't deny that he had done it, but he promised it would never happen again. Of course, you know, things escalated. And she did not end her relationship with him behind that, which I thought she would have. But as a 10 or 11-year-old at that time, I felt like, okay, I told one of the people I trust the most. They stayed together, so now I just have to survive. And I think I basically lived in survivor mode survivor and repression mode from the time I was 11 years old until I was about 18 when I, you know, left home. And then it wasn't until I was in my 20s and I had had a nervous breakdown that I decided to really confront dealing with my pain. And then I sought to press charges against my perpetrator, and I was eventually successful in doing that. But I think for me, repression was my way of coping. I didn't turn to drugs. I didn't turn to alcohol. But I kept myself busy. If I stayed busy with several jobs and going to college and doing activities, then I never had to sit and have time to sulk until I created a bomb for healing in my life.
Well, you know, lots of times many survivors may feel disempowered by more than just the perpetrator. Imani, I'm thinking about you. It may be parents. It may be police officers. It may be apathetic friends, teachers. But I'm thinking about what you were saying when you were talking about you told your mother and you expected that that would be it. It would be addressed. Did you feel disempowered at all?
Well, before I answer directly, just for the record, I want to say my mom and I have reconciled and healed a big portion of our relationship. So she's a part of my life now. And she supports, you know, the work that I do with sharing my story, our story. My father, too, actually, my biological father, for that matter. So, you know, I was like 10 or 11 years old when the first inappropriate touch happened. And again, by the time that happened, this was somebody that had won a special place in my heart. This is somebody that, you know, took me on dates with he and my mom. So I think I did feel disempowered, but, you know, when you're 10 or 11 years old, you don't really have language for all of your feelings.
Exactly.
I don't even think you really have understanding for your feelings. There was a part of me that was heartbroken, but I just somehow, I stuffed it and I kept moving forward. And, you know, it wasn't until I was in my early 20s and was introduced to Nichiren Buddhism and chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo that was kind of like the fuse that like set off the bomb in my life for me to really address what I had been repressing and ignoring. But it was like the best thing that ever happened. So.
Misha.
Yes.
Yeah. Often we feel like victims, the victim blaming thing. We have to use, I have to use that word right now. But because, you know, it's as if the victim, you know, holding the victim responsible for the crime, or at least partially responsible for what happened to them. Did you encounter any of this at all?
Not till I was a lot older. Okay. I just really started unraveling kind of my sexual trauma, let's call it 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I in a way, yes, especially I think being as a male of color, there mm-hmm. just wasn't a space where this kind of dialogue ever happened. I didn't even know this was a thing that was a discussion, you know. So it was more I would get questions of like, what did I do, or like what, mm-hmm. what could I have done, and it made me just kind of turn in and really not communicate about any of that, mm-hmm. because it seemed like even though I was becoming aware of something I definitely knew was traumatic, people were asking me how I could have prevented it, and I didn't really know what to do with that at the time.
Mm-hmm. Psychologists estimate that about 40 million adults, 15 million of them, are men, and that they were sexually abused by parents, close relatives, or other elders of both genders. These children are often called secret survivors. So another thing that I wanted to note is that the U.S. is really pretty unique in that it is the only crime, you know, rape is the only crime that there are statutory protections designed in favor of the victim, known as rape shield laws. And these rape shield laws prohibit cross-examination of issues of prior sexual history or the way he or she was dressed. I think that's a positive. I wanted to get your response. I've had some people tell me that they strongly disagree with that. And I wanted to hear from both of you on that, because I see that as a way of trying to, again, blame the victim.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with you on that. And having, you know, I went through two trials mm-hmm. as an adult. Yeah. To prosecute my perpetrator for crimes as a child and a teenager. The first outcome was a hung jury. In the second trial, we secured a conviction, and now he's serving like 20 to 25 years in prison.
Great. But, good for you.
Thank you. But to answer your question more directly, so my personal experience, you know, I think that victims, if victims were cross-examined, mm-hmm. on any aspect of their sexual history that is separate from their abuse, it would be like re-victimizing the person.
Exactly.
So I'm glad that there are shield laws, because the two, even though the two can be related, the two, in my opinion, a person's sexual history to me doesn't have a bearing on if there's truth in what they experienced in mm-hmm. being abused and their ability to speak to that. I think mm-hmm. it's just a way to try to discredit or disempower someone's allegations. So I'm glad that there's shield laws.
Okay. We hear survivors talk so much about triggers, and I wondered if you both would address what are triggers and exactly how do they work?
For me, that's kind of an ongoing evolution in mm-hmm. the understanding of my own triggers. And it's something that I kind of monitor on a daily basis, really. Triggers for me are anything related to sexual aggression, I guess, or sexual abuse. So I have to really monitor what kind of information I'm taking in, mm-hmm. What kind of media I'm taking in, if it's too much, and really be connected enough to myself to be like, okay, I have to turn this off, or, mm-hmm. you know, this is not leaving me in a positive emotional space, because that for me personally, so it'll just send me down a slightly self-destructive path if I don't catch it in time.
Okay.
And for me, I think, triggers are one of the things that I think people should really understand is part of what makes sexual violation on any level such a heinous set of crimes, because long after a physical wound has maybe healed or recovered, like, a survivor has to learn how to re-navigate their personhood or learn how to navigate, like, being in their body. So a trigger can be a smell, it can be a sound, something you see on television that may take you back to a painful memory. And what survivors have to learn how to do as part of the healing process is to learn how to disempower the emotion that comes up when that trigger is present. And that only happens through, to me, I think that really only happens through consistent conscious efforts at healing. I know for me, I did years of therapy. And so now, triggers don't have, I don't get triggered, or if I do get triggered, my personal response is not one that is super shaking, because I put in a lot of work on, my navigating my own emotions, but that's a long, hard process.
Yeah.
It's really a lifelong process.
Do you find you have intrusive memories?
Sometimes, but for me, they're not. I noticed the more therapy that I did and the more that I embraced, I guess, just having a holistic approach to my healing, like developing a strong spiritual practice, trying to develop healthy relationships, doing regular, consistent therapy, I don't have nearly as many as I may have, say, 10 years ago. 15 years ago.
Misha, what about you? I mean, do you experience any flashbacks or PTSD or intrusive memories?
I don't have intrusive memories. I've written so thoroughly about a lot of my abuse that it's allowed me to actually look at it, to put it down in a way where I could deal with it in a way that makes sense to me. It's very possible I have some PTSD. But just in keeping kind of regular eating habits, exercise schedule, sleep schedules, and really being aware of creating relationships that are positive for me is one way to keep a lot of that under wraps. But I think as I was writing about it, because it's so visceral and so visual for me when I write, I just was able to put that there where it was, and it didn't really come, because in writing about it, I lived through it again. So I didn't need to, it wasn't a thing that took me back into that space. So I didn't personally have intrusive memories. It was repressed pretty hard, too, so it didn't come up.
I would think that being a survivor says that you may not be able to trust others, or that trust may be a real issue for you, because you're talking about someone that you may have had some level of trust, and Imani, I think about you, and they violated this trust. Am I thinking in the right direction? Does that make sense?
When you say, like, trusting others, you mean, like, in a specific context, like in personal relationships?
I have had,
it's recently ended, but I've had a long-term relationship for almost about a decade, and trust was definitely something that had to be worked on, although I think I had done a lot of personal work before I met the person I was in a relationship with, and then I continued, in the course of that relationship, I also continued therapy, continued my spiritual practice. But I, in some areas that I thought were healed, definitely got triggered. And then I realized that there was more work to be done. But I think it just comes down to an individual thing. I think for me, I was really motivated that, especially once I got to the point where I could press charges, and then I went through the trials, and then he was convicted, and I start finding my voice and speaking out. I really just got to a place where it was like, I'm taking my life back across the board. So whatever I have to do, like, I want to be open to trusting people and having a relationship and all that. And so I step by step allowed myself to be. And but I mean, like, all of it is a process. It's a process. And you know, kudos to the person that I was dating, because he definitely went through a lot of that healing journey with me, even though it had ups and downs and it wasn't easy.
Well, surviving requires, at least from my perspective, a certain level of self-advocacy. You have to be able to validate self and advocate for who you are and where you're going. At least I'm thinking in that direction. We're going to take a brief break, but when we come back, I'd like to talk about that self-advocacy, and let's look at recovery.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and joining me on the phone, I welcome again Imani Capri and Misha Tyler. We have been looking at, we're going to look at, recovery. And I mentioned that before we went on break, and I want to have you all talk about the self-advocacy that is involved in surviving sexual assault. How does it occur? And, Misha, I'll start with you this time.
Okay. I was, as far as the self-advocacy go, I was in a long-term relationship. Mm-hmm. With someone that really pushed me towards going to get treatment for my sexual abuse. And it was kind of a back and forth for a while, and I think that led me towards self-advocacy and really redefining how I saw myself. You know, I think at that point in time, before I really got treatment, I just tried to stay really small. Mm-hmm. You know, as you know, I'd walk through and just try not to be noticed. You know, and it was kind of a way to protect myself. And I think now, because this is it's an ongoing evolution for me to create, you know, a healthier, a more intact version of myself that I like, I guess, that I like and I'm proud of and I appreciate. And there, I guess that's my self-advocacy in that way, is re-meeting myself.
Mm-hmm.
And re-interacting with myself in a way that I like and I'm proud of and I enjoy being around.
Mm-hmm. Iman.
I think for me, I don't think I really became an advocate for myself until I decided to press charges.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that came from the fact that I had two younger siblings that were still in that household.
Even though I had
left and didn't have an active relationship with them, like, I felt responsible. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about them and their welfare and not ever wanting to hear from them, like, hey, this happened to us too, and then me having to say, oh, mm-hmm. I know because it happened to me first, was the impetus for me to you know, start finding out, looking into the statute of limitations in the state of Ohio and things like that. And in the process, I think I became more of my own self-advocate. But it took a lot of crying. It took a lot of talking with loved ones. It took a lot of, like, challenging my fear of speaking very graphically and publicly about what I experienced to get to the point of thinking, you know, okay, I could press charges, and thinking that, you know, at that point, we're talking about, I'm like 25, 26. We're talking about things that happened when I was 11 up until, you know, 14 in the state of Ohio. So it was just a process, you know, and then I was working on my bachelor's at the same time as preparing for the trial and, like, going to counseling. My Buddhist community and certain friends and family members were awesome support system for me during that time. And some of them, I think, were really influential in teaching me how to be an advocate for myself. The piece that you said, Misha, about, you know, learning more and more how to become like a better version of yourself is, even to this day, like, I know I'm very different from who I was back then, but it's like, because I think I had that experience happened to me at such a young age and for such a long period of time, it really has taken me probably the last 10 or 15 years of my life to, like, reshape my identity and really say, like, who am I? What do I like? What is outside of what I experience? You know? This is a process. This is really a process.
Well, as we look at recovery, I mean, my question to you, and help me understand it, is, does it really ever occur? I mean, it seems like there's some background noise, if we can. It seems that after one experiences a rape or a violation or a sexual abuse, that you can never get back to the before it happened state. Does that make sense? I mean, what does recovery involve?
And I don't think the objective, I guess, for me is to get to the before it happens state. That seems like such a foreign land. You know, like, I see it, and if that, for me to think in that way, seems like me setting myself up for failure already. It's more integrating, you know, integrating my experience into my life in a way that's not self-destructive or doesn't create a sense of self-harm.
I think. Yes. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, for me personally, I think recovery is really, it's an individual journey, and for me, I would venture to say that I am recovered. And a big part for me was continually to, like, challenging my fears, being willing to look at the pain, and then being willing to do the work to take the pain and turn it into something valuable, like Misha said, in terms of incorporating. So for me, a big part of that was finding my voice, and how every time that I would speak or share my story, it was like it was healing for me, but I also noticed that it did something for other people. And so it's like you take the pain and you repurpose it, you transmute it into something that has value, something that has, like, a healing power in it for yourself and for others. And so that, along with, you know, therapy, just learning how to care for myself on a more holistic level, and creating a healthy lifestyle, has really put me in a space now where I look at it like, you know, it was maybe a divine purpose that I went through that experience to be able to help other people. So what is there, if I take that perspective, I mean, I'm strong enough to have that perspective now, but I don't know. That's just how I've chosen to look at it. And because I look at it and deal with it from that standpoint of view, I'm free from it.
In these last few minutes, I have 1,000 questions that we won't get through. But there's one that I want to make sure I address, and I'm going to ask it now. What kinds of things would you say to teens or kids who are currently in situations that, like you experienced, both of you? What do you say to them?
I mean, for me, I would definitely say to them that they're, you know, and this might sound strange, but their experience isn't special and it's not strange and it's not an individual experience. You know, just from thinking about my own experience, I felt like it was something that was only happening to me, mm-hmm. and something that I only had to deal with. You know, and that in that process, if it possible to find somebody to even to begin to communicate with that experience about, there's freedom in that. You know, and the opposite, I mean, to contain that and just try to handle it yourself, it's not healthy, and it's a kind of a loop that'll be never ending.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say I actually just had an opportunity to talk to a 14-year-old on Saturday who was at the police station sexual crimes unit.
Wow.
Getting ready to give a statement, and one thing that I said to her, which I would say to teens, is that you're not alone, mm-hmm. that there are people and resources available that are waiting to help you when you're ready to, you know, maybe start sharing or to start the process of your healing. It will not be an easy process. But the extent to which you are willing to open up and speak about what you've experienced, whether it's to police or to a counselor or to a trusted friend or family member, is the beginning of you taking power back over your life. And that silence, breaking silence, is one of the ways that we do not protect the person who's abused us. A lot of times, we look at silence as like, oh, I'm just being quiet to kind of avoid dealing with it,
mm-hmm.
or just to move
Indeed.
On or to protect myself. But people don't really realize, like, in the silence, you protect the person who harmed you,
mm-hmm.
which then means that they may go to do that to someone else. So I would just encourage young people to know that they aren't alone, that there is a community of people and resources available to help, and that encourage them to just be courageous to take the first step.
Yeah.
As you think about your experiences to this point, share the repercussions of this type of trauma for my listening audience, so they have a grasp, a feel for what, you know, is to come from this.
The repercussions of the trauma for me?
Yes.
I mean, even currently, still we're talking about trust, it's left me with a lot of trust issues, a lot of personal insecurity, a lot of fear. At times, and not all the time, just a feeling as if, you know, something about me is just unhealable and maybe unmanageable, and maybe something that should not be around other people at times, just in the repercussions of that whole, I mean, for me, this was also like multiple occurrences of abuse throughout my life.
Mm-hmm.
So it at times makes it difficult for me to have the kind of relationships that I think I need and that would be healthy for me. And it's now, it's better than, let's say, yesterday or before, but it's still, I mean, the repercussions, I feel like it's going to be a lifelong process, and,
right.
and my healing journey will be the work that I'm going to do to create the life that I want to live.
Okay. Yes. And I think the fact that you said it's ongoing and it's lifelong. And I think that's really a key component to surviving and recovery. Mm-hmm. Would you agree, Imani? You disagree?
I do. Okay. I know. I do agree. I guess I would say the repercussion, two of the biggest repercussions for me have been really learning what self-love is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes when you experience something traumatic, especially I think if you experience it as a child, and I'm not sure why this is, but it's so easy to internalize and to blame yourself, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. to think like, oh, well, you know, something was wrong to where my parents didn't protect me enough, or something was wrong with me. I wasn't worthy of their love or their protection.
Right.
Like identifying that lie and breaking and healing from that mm-hmm. whole, like, distorted belief system was a big repercussion. And then learning how to process my anger. Mm. And I think I would, mm-hmm. I don't even know if anger is the word, I would say maybe rage is a more accurate,
uh-huh.
is a more accurate description, yeah. because it's like, and Nisa, I totally get why you're laughing, because anger doesn't even begin to really give people an understanding.
No, not at all.
And sometimes it may be like, you get to different points in your life and you realize like, oh, this is related to, mm-hmm. this is a byproduct of what I went through. And then it's like this, it's just like this explosive rage, but you can't, you know, you have to find like healthy ways to channel that. So that has been, I would say, the second biggest repercussion. And the third, and I really have to credit, I think, just my spiritual path with this, is I now have appreciation. I'm not saying that I appreciate the experience, but I'm saying that the value that I've been able to take out of the experience is that this whole process taught me how strong I am, how resilient I am, that I can use something horrible, I can flip it and use mm-hmm. it to help encourage other people. And so that has been the repercussion that was unexpected and that I'm super pumped about.
Mm-hmm.
And just letting people know, like, whether you've experienced sexual trauma or not, like, we all have stuff we go through, but we can mm-hmm. all flip it. Sometimes we just need help and resources and a little bit of courage to get started.
Are there, in these last 2 minutes, less than 2 minutes, are there any particular resources or support services that you would like to share with the listening audience? Anything that you found particularly helpful?
So one resource I will share, I was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and end up at this place called the Healing Center, mm-hmm. and their focus is sexual trauma and physical violence, and that was, I guess, my initial resource that kind of led me more towards a direct path on my own healing journey.
Mm-hmm.
I would share, I think, 4 quick resources. Of course, Things We Haven't Said, the book that we contributed to,
yes.
is
excellent.
Tremendous.
It is.
It's a tremendous resource. It's heartfelt. It's powerful. It's easy enough to read in the language. I mean, the stories may not be easy to read, but the language is easy. The other resource I would say is the Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network.org.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in Cleveland, Ohio. The Cleveland Rape Crisis Center is an amazing resource here in Cleveland, Ohio. And then also the Voices and Faces Project in Chicago is another awesome organization that I know about. And RAIN and the Voices and Faces Project are the recipients of the proceeds from the book. So when people buy the book, their money goes towards supporting survivors.
My sincere appreciation for you sharing your thoughts and your experiences. It still can't be easy, okay? So I thank you, and I wish both of you peace. To my listening audience, thank you for your time and your ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Team archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.